Do migrants make the economies they move to more like the ones they've left? Is there a culture transplant? To answer this question, I'm joined by an economist from George Mason University in the United States and author of a new book called The Culture Transplant. Garrett Jones, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great. I think this book has come at an incredibly important time. You know, borders, migration is so politically salient now. Mm-hmm. So let's kick off. There's a lot to talk about. Let's kick off. What is culture transplant theory? What are its basic claims?
Well, the basic idea really is summed up in the subtitle. We know from looking at studies of people moving from one country to another and then looking at their descendants that people who come to, say, the United States from Italy end up having children who hold attitudes that are a lot like those of Italians back in Italy. Mm. So Italian-Americans end up sort of like Italians in Italy. Yeah. Mexican-Americans end up sort of like Mexicans in Mexico. This appears to be true not just for the first generation, but for the second generation, for people who are totally born and raised in the new country. Mm. So for instance, the easiest way to check this is with just studies of savings rates. Frugality. So frugality partly gets imported from the countries people come from. And of course, frugality is a really important value. It's a personal value. How much do you value the future over the present? But it gets passed on in some way from parent to child, and it survives migration. So what it means is that 100% full assimilation is a myth.
Yeah, it is a myth. You're not going to get 100%, but some things change, some things merge, and some things persist, don't they?
Yes.
I mean, language, for instance, does
language
fades.
Exactly.
Fades out. So what are the other things that fade out?
Oh, so for instance, like one popular study in economics shows that basically the names that people give their children end up assimilating on average pretty quickly in the second generation, right?
I think they may do in the States. I'm not sure they do in Europe.
That may not be true. There may be differences there.
Yeah.
This is something that varies by country. The precise issue changes by country. So in one study of just migration across Europe, moving from one Europeans moving from one country to another and then looking at the second generation, one thing that where there's pretty much full assimilation is how do you feel about the police? So, and the reason why is probably pretty obvious, which is that people look at the police around them and say, well, the police here are pretty good, so I like them, or the police here are pretty crummy, so I don't like them.
So there's no reason for their ancestral belief to persist.
Yes. Whereas on the other hand, the view of how do you feel about the role of government? Should the government take care of people, or should people mostly take care of themselves? In a study of Europeans moving from one country to another, that's strongly persistent into the second generation. So some values persist and some values don't.
How long are we talking about, Garrett? I mean, you say the second. You've got data probably in the States goes back way before that. Does it? What about third, fourth, fifth?
Well, one can do this, for instance, with the third generation in some studies. I know a study of savings, for instance, that looks at the third generation, and some studies of attitudes toward trust. Can you basically trust strangers? That looks at what we might call the fourth generation. The problem is that looking at people's, we're relying on surveys, right? And if you ask somebody in the survey, where was your mom born? People are gonna answer that and know the right answer, right? If you ask people who are fourth generation Americans, where did your ancestors come from? There's just, people don't really know. And you've got so many ancestors, right? When you go back that many generations, you get a lot of noise in the data. So it's we can most believe the results from the second generation, I'd say.
I've often asked people, actually, when they talk about ancestry and their names, because we names go through the male line generally in our society. And people say, I'm a so-and-so, you might be a McDonald's or something. And I say, well, just get a pen and write down the names of your parents and your grandparents and you get to see how far you go. Anyway, so one of the important things I think the book brings out is that prosperity isn't sort of accidental. It has cultural foundations, doesn't it? It's quite clear. And if that's true, we accept that view, then you've got to look at which cultural traits make this so. You mentioned saving. Saving, very important. I've listed from the book trust, ideas about governance and personal responsibility. So if you have a population that has the top of the good list for all these things, you know, we save, we're industrious, we have a sense of ourselves and the public good, and then you transport that population somewhere else, that will determine the somewhere else. So we should look at examples. The USA, your own country, is a great example of this, where pre-colonization, it wasn't a prosperous place, was it?
No. So within the Americas, before the Columbian invasions, It was clear that the richest places were closest to the equator.
Yeah.
But once the Europeans came along, the richest places started being further from the equator, right?
Yeah.
So this is, if someone believed in purely geographic theories of history, they've got a real problem there.
Yeah.
Because the locus of prosperity switched from close to the equator to places a lot further away.
Yeah.
So Daron Acemoglu, famous economist, refers to places like the United States, Canada, Chile, Australia, as neo-Europes.
Mm.
And it's pretty obvious why economists use this term neo-Europes all the time, because when Europeans moved, they brought the values with them. People aren't calling them neo-Europes because people brought copies of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations with them.
Mm.
People are calling it, people are calling these places neo-Europes because Europeans moved in large numbers.
Europeans moved and they imported and brought with them their ideas about governance and agriculture. I mean, I'll talk about your scoring system a bit later, but you've got, you know, thousands of years of knowledge and expertise in agriculture. You just import it mm-hmm. in, and then it becomes the norm. So prosperity migrates, doesn't it? That's the
mm-hmm.
idea. And in this competition between why is that place quite wealthy and why is that place not so, it's a competition between sort of places theory and people's theory. You're a people's theory.
Yeah, the people's theory, when we test the places theory versus the people's theory wins. It's not that geography doesn't matter at all. When I look at a place like Singapore, I look at the UK. I mean, Adam Smith was right. The UK's geography with a lot of opportunities for coastal trade, inland waterways like the Thames.
Sure.
This obviously is really important for making a country prosperous. But when you moved English people to North America, to places that didn't have as many geographic advantages, worked just fine.
They still did okay, yeah. And I think certainly the founding fathers, I think there was also probably a creaming effect. I mean, I think the people who went to the States, like a lot of migrants, weren't a representative sample of their populations.
No.
But the ideas of embedded rights go with them.
Yeah, the United States has been lucky to have selective migration.
Yeah.
Some of the best in the world have tended to come to the United States for centuries, and we've benefited from that.
Mm. Now, in the book, you focus on the Chinese diaspora, don't
mm-hmm.
you, in Southeast Asia, which is very interesting. My father had businesses in Southeast Asia when we were kids, and traveled to Hong Kong, Malaysia, and Singapore a lot. And you stay on Scots Road in the 70s, and there's banging and hammering going. And what I didn't really realize what was happening was they were building the best economy in the world.
Mm-hmm.
in front of me, it was quite incredible. And Boat Quay, I remember as a child, it was full of junks, and Dad's office was just in a little sort of place with no aircon or anything. And they built this incredible place. And you're linking its success to another migration, the migration of Chinese people
yes.
out of China and into various places. And you say the data, I mean, even someone just noticing it would see it probably, but
mm-hmm.
you say the data strongly supports the idea that the prosperity is linked to that culture, because every time they've had freedom, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, even little Macau
mm-hmm.
has become prosperous.
Exactly.
So that's the theory.
So yes, if we looked in say the year 1500 before the Columbian invasion sort of overturned the map of the world, you know, China was very close to the frontier of technology, of governance quality, and over the next five centuries, we saw that when people of Chinese descent moved in large numbers to countries across Southeast Asia in particular, they tend to carry their cultures with them.
Mm.
And it's obvious to anyone who travels in these regions at the most mundane level. This is a case where language assimilation is not complete, right?
Mm.
As one can see from just seeing the signs or listening to the people talking in the streets.
Do you have to be big enough? Because I want to talk about assimilation next, but does it depend on population size? So if you import a lot of people, I mean, Singapore, modern Singapore, what is, 75%, 80% Chinese, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah.
So you're big enough to look after yourself.
60, yeah.
Yeah, 60. Yeah. It was the simple majority. But if you're a small population
uh-huh.
going to somewhere, doesn't that put more pressure on assimilation? So
part of it will just happen naturally over two or three generations, right?
Mm.
If we're thinking, I mean, I'm not really particularly interested in the language question, but obviously you can't keep a language network up without a lot of people speaking,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's so visible across the Chinese diaspora,
mm.
And it's so economically important
mm.
that it's become a touch point for cultural conflict, right, across
yeah.
With riots in multiple Southeast Asian countries against the prosperous, successful Chinese minority, right? Not everybody who's Chinese is prosperous there, but people know correctly.
The group is.
Yeah.
Yeah, the group is. And again, I wanted to bring this up. We may as well bring it up now. you know, we're the slogan is diversity is strength. And again, I'll talk about that a bit later. But the reality of different groups in mixed societies having antagonism and leading to, in some cases, pogroms and outright racial mm-hmm. conflict is there, isn't it? So if you want to create a very multi-ethnic, multi-racial society, you've got to be aware that's likely to happen. It's a, I think you call it a hardy perennial.
A hardy perennial, yes. Yeah. Cultural conflict. People like to find, our species likes to find ways to divide ourselves, mm. whether it's over religion, over gender, over culture and ethnicity, and we find ways to fight, and that's unfortunate. Mm. I think that's part of something that we have to live with, and I think that a country would probably be poorer if everyone were identical clones. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's something to this idea that that there's a sort of a Laffer curve, a Goldilocks level of diversity that helps nations, and it'll differ on different issues. Mm. You know, I'm here in London, and of course there was a solid century of religious disputes where people find ways to kill each other over religious interpretations. Mm. So people will always find something to fight over, but we don't need to fuel the fire without a clear benefit.
Without a clear benefit, yeah. I mean, this is like a sort of balance sheet thing on immigration policy. As I see it now, certainly in our own country, you're quite a fan of expertise, and in previous books you've written mm-hmm. about that. As I look at Britain's immigration policy, I would say it's governed neither by experts nor by the public. Uh-huh. So the public would have lower immigration, experts might have better, more selective immigration, we just don't get either. Why do you think that happens?
I think it's partly because voters themselves hold muddled issues. The elites and the elected officials in government reflect the muddled views of voters. Mm. So and part of that is they're reflecting the views that voters when it comes to immigration, people the masses are afraid of the competition from people who are more skilled than them, right? Mm. Economists we can very glibly tell people, and I believe this, that like having mass immigration of high-skilled folks is going to create some short-term disruptions, but it's pretty likely going to create mass prosperity over a generation or so. Wrote a piece about this for The Telegraph. But it's hard to sell normal people on this.
But it depends. Yeah,
politicians reflect our own incoherent views on this issue.
They do, and some politicians are completely incoherent. I find, but that's true. But I think the basics of a lot of low skilled migration into a labour market will depress. I think it will just depress wages and discourage training. I think that's what happens. If you rely on that, that's what it is.
Here I do have to push back slightly and say that at least for the many studies in the US, this may not apply to the UK, it's possible, that basically the invisible hand is really good at exploiting labor, right? And finding ways to use new workers in ways that are quite productive. I've written in the past that like the estimates are that one might find small negative effects of mass low-skilled immigration in the short run on wages. It's a little hard to tell. It's a little bit, the idea that the invisible hand is very good at finding ways to use unexploited resources, and labor is an unexploited resource.
Yeah, but the problem is that we're getting into a diversion.
Sure, sure.
Get back into that. But it's good. But I think the problem in the UK is that we have the sort of worst of all worlds. We have too many people in university. And you have skills training, which is inadequate, vocational skills training, which is inadequate. And you end up, after deindustrializing, with 5.5 million adults on out-of-work benefits, at the same time as importing 1.4 gross and 750,000 net. And so successive governments use migration as a sort of an easy drug, quick one, instead of doing the hard work of getting that population back into effective employment.
Here's something that I think there's support for, which is that mass higher education, mass college degrees, for when people get skills that just aren't that competent, ends up basically raising people's expectations in the labor market and makes them much pickier about jobs.
Elite overproduction.
It's
not good. Michael Lind, the people like that, I think are probably right about that.
So I think there's something important to that, and that has both cultural and economic consequences that are still underappreciated.
Yeah, and it will be different in different pockets. I agree, but I'm sort of the SDP is a pro-worker family basically, so I think we're sticking to that. So just on the question, just to go back to the question of conflict. What we would advocate is something which is a bit more sophisticated than you sometimes get, which is what we advocate is is in a society that's quite diverse is civilized toleration of differences. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you've got to be better at saying, actually, that group is doing that thing and that group's doing sort of I'm wise enough to accept that that might be just the way it rolls. Do you think that's the right approach?
Yeah, I think that the sort of civilized tolerance is the
massively important. Massively important.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's your only chance.
I mean, this is something that Britain had to figure out with its religious wars. Mm. And I think people are going to have to find this out again in the 21st century.
Yeah. Right, so the next sort of claim that you make, which is really interesting, which is that you say assimilation is a myth. So immigrants import, you know, culture and it sticks. And that's attitude persistence, which we've dealt with a little bit with Italian Americans, mm-hmm. and so on. But I think I want to link that to why the things they believe in are important for the economy, which is what you're basically talking about. And I want to focus in on one thing, get under it a bit, which is trust. Mm-hmm. Trust and trustworthiness. Mm-hmm. Why is trust important to the economy?
Oh, because so many of our exchanges that we engage in the market involve the need to trust somebody else, or else the exchange won't happen in the first place. Mm. So one of my colleagues, John Nye, points out that when your child gets a fever, you're willing to go into a store and buy something off the shelf give a pill to your child, like Tylenol or acetaminophen, to your child as a fever reducer, even though it's made by somebody you've never met. Mm. Right? This could be poison. So one needs a huge amount of trust in some kind of social system to make that work. Otherwise, you just say, well, I'm just going to let us sweat this out because I'm not going to let my child take something that might be poison.
What other ways is it important, though? I mean, openness.
Well, for instance, it shows up in sort of in political negotiations between two parties. Mm. It shows up when people are going to decide to invest in a project. I'm going to invest, you know, $500,000 in your project, and I'm going to take something called shares as no contract, really. And I hope that if you make some profits, you'll give that back to me in the future.
You say that in the book that it explains, because Italy is a phenomenal place. I'm a Lucifer. I love Portugal. That's my speciality in Europe. But Italy, I don't think you could beat Italy for culture and history. You just can't. It's pointless trying, really. But you say it's quite a low trusting society, isn't it? And you say that one of the reasons for the family businesses there is that they don't trust joint stock companies.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, this is work by Schleifer and Vishny at Harvard, got people thinking about this back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And just looking across countries, very few people can pull off joint stock companies at a really large scale. The US can do it. Mm. Italy cannot. And so when one sees family-run businesses that are these large conglomerates, that's a signal of low trust. It's not a perfect signal, but it's a sign that you can only trust people who are in the clan, right? And so, boy, we wish we could scale up. Maybe it'd be great if we could just go to the credit markets and raise $1 or $2 or $3 billion, but nobody's going to believe us when we say we're going to actually spend this on something useful.
It does cut across. I mean, obviously, it also imposes a cost, doesn't it? Because low trust, it sort of implies some criminality. My youngest left his phone in a taxi we were in Genoa once, and we went to the authorities and said, you know, how about getting this? They just left us. What are you? You've got no chance of getting that phone back. And of course, we didn't. We didn't get it back. And there's lots of other examples. I mean, I have been a Ghana, when I was there, I was doing some charity work. But the you look at investment opportunities, you say, and you chat to lots of people, say, that would work. That would be the problem. Isn't could you invest? Is how you get how you keep the money.
How can you keep the money? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when you invest money in somebody else's project, they can come up with a lot of ways to spend it that make good sense to them.
We'll just take it off you,
right?
We'll just take it off you. I'm having that, thank you. Yeah, no, that's the basics. So so it is important, and it feeds through. So if you import a society, if you import a population that has very low trust, it will impact your economy eventually.
It seems very likely. Does. It shows up. Yeah. It's a strong predictor in statistical studies across countries. Some version of it shows up in many economics experiments. And it turns out that the simple survey measure, just asking people, do you think people can generally be trusted or do you have to watch out for yourself? That ends up having a lot of predictive power across a lot of different studies. It's a little different in different studies. Sometimes people who say you can't trust people are telling on themselves.
Yes.
So it's self-revelation, right? And
it's
sometimes
projection.
Yeah, it's projection.
Yeah.
So it's a little hard to tell the context of the study, but it usually signals something that is not great.
Yeah, and the Swedes come up the top of the pops, don't they?
Scandinavians in general seem to have this. it makes it a little bit more puzzling that they were a little bit late to the world of prosperity, to the Industrial Revolution, right?
It does.
It does.
And you say, you mentioned the book, you know, places like Dakota, which I suppose Minnesota would be the same.
Yeah, exactly.
We've a lot of Nordics, and then, of course, it's a high trust society. Yeah, no, I've often...
And those places are great, they're excellent, and they're not at the economic frontier.
No, it's interesting. So the other thing that's important economically eventually, which is, you talk about savings rate, you know, and frugality uh-huh. feeding through. And like, you know, if you're very elementary economics, you introduce these equations like, you know, savings equals investment. Uh-huh. Which I was like, it depends what you do. It depends whether the savings are underneath the bed. But the savings rate, crudely, the theory would be the savings rate, a high savings rate would lead to high investment. Yeah. High investment would lead to higher future income. Correct?
And it also, people who save more, it's probably a signal of forward thinking across many parts of life, right? Investing in your children's education rather than going on a vacation yourself. Yes. These kind of things that'll show up in many parts of your life.
Yeah, and societies that do that end up getting more prosperous.
Yes.
And profligate societies just...
This is one of our best predictors of, most robust predictors of prosperity is savings rates at the micro level. Savings rates at the cross-country level, And it turns out that this is something, part of the reason I put a lot of weight on these savings studies is because nobody can come up with a story, people can come up with stories about trust doesn't really matter or trust is overrated or whatever, but everyone knows that saving for the future is good, right?
Yeah.
And you can measure it, right?
But not everyone does it, though.
Not everyone does it.
No.
It's a personal preference.
Yeah.
Like, you might wish that you would save, but you just kind of never get around to it because, you know, you got to go out with your friends tonight.
Yeah.
But
your key insight is, and this is the fascinating thing, this is why I think it's well worth reading the book and well worth getting these ideas out there and understanding it, because you're saying that these savings rates and attitudes towards frugality are important and will determine what sort of economy you're going to get. But you say they're sticky. That's the key thing.
They're sticky, and
it means that the savings rate of a third generation Chinese person in the United States would be more like China than some other population in the States.
On average, yes.
On average,
it's pretty clear. And we have studies now from looking at data from Germany and from the UK. And since my book came out, there's been a study looking at US immigrants, second generation. Mm. And in all these cases, there's really good evidence that savings rates, savings behaviors, whether you save for retirement, these things are sticky to the second generation. In one study, we've got evidence to the third generation.
Mm. So. Yeah, I've seen some data comparing Britain to Germany on high time preference and deferred gratification that says Germans are slightly more better, you know, higher in this hierarchy than we are. We're more likely to sort of spend now. It's just the stickiness is fascinating me because I think all of these things you just get. I mean, you know Gregory Clark's work,
of course,
on
great, yeah.
Yeah, and I think he's great. So just to explain that, so he's done a lot of work on social mobility, mm-hmm. and how sticky certain groups are, mm-hmm. right across the generation. I think his The Sun Also Rises book. Mm-hmm. So he's going way back, isn't he? I mean, massive.
He's got data going back, across many cultures, across many centuries.
Yeah.
So my colleague John Nye has worked with him on some data on that for Russia. And so Greg Clark, part of his method is looking at rare last names and basically finding out that people with rare last names who were rich in, the 15 or 1600s in Europe tend to be rich today. And especially he started off doing this with England, right? And so these people with these rare last names who are prosperous tended to have a lot more children. And so those names become persistent across the generations, more common across the generations. Mm. And people with these rare last names who are less prosperous, their names sort of fade out over time, right? So he's using last names as a way to get around a lot of statistical problems.
Yeah.
But he can show it for centuries. So he's finding a kind of persistence that is going on for centuries.
And I think that, again, I'm going to give you two little examples, not in your book, but just my thoughts on it, which are things like, if you look at voting patterns in Portugal now, there's a very strong Bloco Esquerda, which is the proper left, the proper, you know, very left. Communist Party on Avenida Liberdade got a, you know, big thing. And in the Alentejo, in the Algarve, they get really very high votes. I mean, they're very, you know, 20% of the vote, 25% of the vote regularly. Their church going is not as high. And in the very latest Portuguese elections, you could see, you could warm your hands on the signal that it was giving in voting patterns, sub-Alentejo, and to the north. And why? Because they're completely different populations. The Alentejo population is an Arab population. After the Reconquest, they stayed there. They were Christianized, but they weren't really. And I just think it's fascinating that that difference in a population shows through in voting now, and that's 800 years ago.
Yeah, this is something for political scientists to look at, right? Economists too, right? So we found culture transplants in so many places. I'm sure that the Iberian Peninsula is a great place to look at that.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. Now, on page 50, you make a claim, which is not a very politically correct claim, but it is there. You claim that disparities in wealth between Europe and sub-Saharan Africa are not attributable to slavery or colonization.
Because at least they have a large degree.
To a large degree, yes. I mean, it's not those didn't have an impact. Of course they didn't. You can measure the impact. But the basic disparities in income are not really to do with that. They're to do with what you get onto now, which is you focus on quite a lot, which is state history, agricultural history, and tech history. And you develop this sort of SAT score, state, agriculture, tech. Could you just explain what you're talking about there and which of those three things are the most important?
Yeah, sure. So this is a work by Putterman and Weil at Brown University. Started off looking at, they basically wanted to check and see, is past prologue, right? Was how the world was set up in 1500, do those outcomes that were existing in 1500, do they pretty much persist through today? So if we just look at the old world, you would say that, wow, in Western Europe, they'd had organized states for a long time. China had had organized states for quite a much longer time. And those places are today are fairly prosperous. So if we look at where the most prosperous places in the old world, we'd say it's Western Europe and East Asia, right? Those are the places that had the most state sophistication back then, the longest history of agriculture. And that's pretty predictive of the way things
went. Well, Iraq had the longest history of...
Exactly. That's a great point.
Yeah.
So when it comes to agricultural and state history, the Fertile Crescent would be the place that had the highest scores, the longest history of state and agricultural development. And so the question is, well, why aren't those places the most prosperous today, aside from places that have natural resources? And this is where Bill Easterly's work of NYU comes to be so important. So he was doing work at about the same time with a team of researchers. And what he looked at was, instead of looking at whether you had centuries of history with agriculture, centuries of history with organized states, instead looking, just taking a snapshot of 1500. And 1500 was your place in the world using the best technology available. Were you using wheels? Were you using printing presses? Did you have organized militaries? Did you have an organized government? And so tech history, T, in the SAT score, that turned out to be statistically the best predictor of modern prosperity in the old world. And it's kind of no surprise, right? Which is that if you take a snapshot right at 1500, that's probably going to give you a better picture of today than averaging things off of the last 2, 3, even 5,000 years. And so Bill Easterly's work, the T in tech in the SAT score, turns out to be the best predictor. And it's actually Easterly who said that one does a better job predicting one does a good job predicting sub-Saharan African prosperity today by knowing their level of tech history before at 1500. So basically, sub-Saharan Africa was not at the lowest. The New World was actually at the lowest back then in 1500. But they were quite low then, and they're not close to the economic frontier today.
Yeah. I mean, Ethiopia is an interesting country because that has very ancient state,
very
continual
ancient
state
roots,
history.
Yes.
Fascinating country. I was lucky to visit that 20 years ago, and it was just... quite an amazing place. But tech history at 1500 in Abyssinia, probably not very high.
Not at the frontier, no. But
links across the to the Arab world and India with that.
That shows up in the data, and also the fact that their state history and agricultural history are so long, that's important too. My colleague Tyler Cowan has written about this in the past, saying that like if one wants to pick a place in sub-Saharan Africa that has sort of some upside option value, it's easy to look at Ethiopia, Eritrea, that region of the world, the Horn, and say, like, there's just something that's been there for millennia and it might reawaken again.
Very, very deep, yeah. So yeah. I found it an incredibly impressive culture to visit. As far as the state goes, sadly, not getting involved in a war with Tigray would help. And it's every time Ethiopia looks as if it's going to be the new mm-hmm. thing, then something awful happens, and it did, you know, 2 years ago, 600,000 people have been killed in that war. Desperate. The next thing is diversity is our strength, which is the progressives' slogan, mm-hmm. and it's like a sort of religion. We all hear it all the time. But you say that, I mean, it's certainly questionable. There is some diversity does give you some things, but I would say it's more of a challenge than the strength. And you describe it, I think, you ask whether it's an unscientific cliche. Is it an mm-hmm. unscientific cliche?
Yeah, I think that, for instance, this is a case where people who talk about the subject don't really want to talk about it, so they use fuzzy language. They use blurry language very often.
Academics.
Academics.
If they want to keep their job.
And pundits.
If they want to keep their job.
Pundits and politicians as well.
Yeah.
So we use the word diversity to lump together both skill diversity, you know, let's have, okay, we're a corporation and we're building a new smartphone. We should probably have somebody who's good at tech and somebody who's good at user interface and somebody who can handle the legal stuff.
Yeah.
Skill diversity is
obviously,
really important.
Obviously. Yeah.
This is a version of Adam Smith's division of labor all over again.
Yeah.
Now, pointing that out also should remind you, like, it's hard to manage that. Getting an engineer to work with a lawyer is hard. So, like, that overcoming those diversity problems itself is a problem that every org needs to solve.
Getting anyone to work with a lawyer is
hard. So there's some what I call skill diversity, or what in the book I call Firefly diversity after the TV show Firefly. There are a lot of these, sci-fi often creates these worlds where there are people who come from different backgrounds, but they all have different skills that they bring to the table, and they all need to bring their skills together to solve a problem. And I think that kind of diversity, with a little bit of good management and social tolerance, can obviously become a strength, and that shows up in business research. On the other hand, ethnic diversity seems to be more like a challenge.
It's
either
challenge,
neutral
yeah.
or
yeah.
a challenge.
Yeah.
And this is even in corporate settings, in business settings, studies run by management professors, where basically the firm has already tried to hire the right people. They've already tried to hire people who aren't win-win thinkers who get along in the team. And even then, ethnic diversity is neutral to negative. That I'd say is the right way to sum up a whole lot of business literature.
And you're looking at the data, and you're not just using silly cliches. But you get a great story. Go on.
No. To me, what's interesting is that in the I look at business studies in particular because these people have an interest in solving the problem on the ground, right? And if they can't fix it when they have huge skin in the game, that's a tough problem. And these are I'm looking at mass workers, the bulk of the labor force here. I think it's a very different story when you're talking about corporate boards.
Well, the first example that you cite in this chapter is a very interesting one of different tribes in Kenya working on the same flower projects. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. So this is working on flowers, actually building bouquets of flowers, more or less. And so in Kenya, there are two large ethnic groups that are culturally dominant. And at this, an economist was able to get access to data at this one company that hired people from both ethnic groups to basically process raw flowers and turn them into what we call bouquets for shipping around the world. And these people are working on three-person teams, and they get essentially randomly assigned. So sometimes you'll randomly get two people from the same ethnic group working together, and sometimes they'll be of opposite ethnic groups. It turned out that in this study, both ethnic groups were equally productive when they worked with their own team. So there's no difference between the
teams.
They
just get on with it.
Also, each group, it's not like one group is the high-skilled group and one is the low-skilled group. They're both the same. It's just the cultural difference. And so it turns out when you put them both together, you get something like, I think, about an 8% drop in productivity.
Yeah.
And it turns out that when there was a big political election going on that led to some cultural conflict.
And some violence.
That showed up in the workforce immediately.
It made
them even less productive.
Yeah.
And these are workers who are being paid piece rates. These weren't hourly workers who get paid the same no matter what. These guys had an incentive to make it work.
And they didn't. So, yes, their own wages going down didn't worry them as long as their enemies... wages went
down
as well.
This is a very human experience, right? It's something we all share. It's unfortunate that, you know, the most famous study is like looking at some place very far away from all of us, but in a way that illustrates it's a human universal.
I think I'll give you a couple of examples from my own experience. So the charity I work for in Ghana, they've set up labs for Africa, and it's to try and diagnose people, treat them, because treatment often is quite straightforward and simple, but diagnosing is difficult. Now, on that, I'm not dobbing anyone in, but because you don't know which lab it is, But there's evidence that some of the staff there literally do go on the go slow to other tribes.
Oh, that's very important.
Dominant. Yeah, and they just go, I'm just not going to treat you very well. I'm not going to treat you very quickly. And if it's cancer, you might, you know. Yeah. So this is really quite stark, you know.
And it's a human universe.
And it's there, yeah. But on the other hand, if you're in a Kumasi and you're in Ashanti and you're the dominant group that's enslaved all the other groups for years, then if you're one of the other groups, maybe you have that. I don't know. The other example, it's not an example of the same thing, but it just showed a situation in the Omo Valley in Ethiopia 20 years ago when I visited down there. It was like a little Europe, the Omo Valley, very south, not real Ethiopia in the sense that it's Amharic, it's totally sub-Saharan African, very different, not Christian. And you had all these little groups, you know, the Semai and the Hammer and all the Mursi and all these tribes, but really strictly geographically controlled, you know, and the smaller tribes had alliances with the bigger ones. And I chatted to someone and said, well, what happens if a Mursi goes, well, we'll just kill them. You know, so it's really quite stark and strict. Yeah, yeah. So it's there. To bring it back to sort of our own societies or type of societies, so the diversity is strength stuff. It was Putnam, wasn't it, in Bowling Alone that really started, opened it up to, yes, it's a challenge.
Yes, and he wrote a book after that actually looked at this more clearly on how he wrote an essay called E Pluribus Unum, but he writes it with a question mark, which is out of the American slogan, out of many, one.
Yeah.
And he treats it as a question mark, just like I treat whether diversity is our strength as a question mark.
Yeah, yeah.
And he really couldn't find evidence that diversity was our strength. This was the most famous paper in the social sciences showing that at least at the local level, people who lived in high ethnic diversity neighborhoods tend to have lower trust in their neighbors. Mm. That result has turned out to be quite strong. Mm. It turns out a little more fragile if you look at whether having local ethnic diversity makes you trust your nation less or trust your government less.
That's not as clear.
But yeah. Like basically local ethnic diversity seeming to hurt local levels of trust is a pretty robust result that I think we should use as a sort of, people should keep it in their heads somewhere.
Because it should be a warning.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. A warning for us, really, a party of the economic left, is that because we're keen on social solidarity, we're keen on sharing, we're keen on what we would call public goods. Would you say that attitudes towards trust and mutuality feed through into public policy?
Absolutely.
How does that work?
Just within the last few days, the late Alberto Alesina of Harvard had his final paper published. Mm. In economics, it takes years to publish. So he passed away, unfortunately, quite a few years ago. And it was just published. And this is where he pulls together his research showing that places with high ethnic diversity, people are less likely to support high levels of economic redistribution.
Yeah.
So to people who are libertarian, my libertarian friends think that's great news. Mm. Hey, we'll have a lot of ethnic diversity, and then we won't trust each other, and therefore we won't let the government create a welfare state. That's going to shrink government. And I think that might have other side effects that are very important and worth worrying about, but for a party of the left like yours, just the mere fact that it's going to hurt political support for redistribution is itself a bad thing, right?
I think it's a terrible thing, because what happens is literally, if you can't convene the mutuality in the public political sphere, literally all of the public goods, the trams, the health service, anything you want to do together, and by the way, I do think it's much more efficient to do things together. I think you get much more bangs for your buck. I think places like Singapore prove that. You have a much more sensible public transport system. We all chip in and do it. But if the political desire for that erodes because people aren't willing to share with others, then it's a real problem for us.
So this shows up not just in lower support for economic redistribution, sort of classic payment schemes that we think about, but also things like building roads and schools. Things that are what economists would often think of as public goods. Mm. Well, schools maybe not. That's more like a private good that we run but through the government. But roads certainly, right?
Yeah.
And so
not just
cutting checks for people, right?
Yeah,
it's building the things that we all share together. And it seems as though, like again, Alesina's work has been really important on this. It's unfortunate we lost him at such a young age because he was willing to take brave stances on this. And this work that showing that higher levels of ethnic diversity and higher levels of immigration in particular seem to undercut support for redistribution across a wide variety of countries. This seems like important enough that everyone should keep it in mind.
We should keep it in mind because I want to move on in a sec, but we should keep it in mind. But I think the importance of it is that not only does it, I'm concerned that it erodes the demand for health services and trams, but I think it also diverts attention into racial preference programs and other things, which I think are not always helpful either, but we'll leave that for the moment. You wrote a very interesting chapter, I thought, on something you called the I-7. Mm-hmm. And this is public policy, this is international public policy, really, you're looking at. Mm-hmm. The importance of protecting the I-7. Could you tell us what the I-7 is and why they are important for the rest of humankind?
Yes, so the I-7 are the world's seven most innovative nations. And it's three in Asia, three in Europe, and the US. Mm. And so the ones in Asia are China, Japan, and South Korea. The ones in Europe are the UK, France, and Germany, and then the US. So, and this shows up whether you look at, if you look at research and development spending, total research and development spending, not per person, that shows up there. It also shows up in patenting, the amounts of patents that are created. And in Nobel Prizes, it shows up in a rougher way, although Asian countries are underrepresented, partly because they weren't in the game for Nobels for most of the sample.
The UK is overrepresented.
Yes.
And underrepresented in R&D, actually.
And of course, and Sweden and Switzerland, of course, excuse me, Switzerland in particular does quite well under the Nobels, even with such a small population, right? Mm. So, but the important thing to note about innovation is that inventions, as we learned through COVID, inventions made in one place in the world get diffused everywhere.
Diffusion,
My smartphone is a Samsung, it's designed in South Korea, I can use it just fine all throughout the world. People around the world are using these phones made in just a couple of places. Mm. So technology ends up spreading the world over. Mm. So all of us everywhere in the world depend on how innovative these nations are. Mm. And it would be great if we could add, a few more to the club that would be super high innovators.
There are some countries that you, I think your expression is they deserve an honorable mention, don't
exactly.
they? Exactly. Brazil, Israel, Russia, mm-hmm. one or two places where innovation does take place. But
often the problem is that they're popular. In the case of Israel and Switzerland in particular, those are countries that are just too small to basically get big enough to give us enough ideas. So on a per capita basis, they're doing great.
Yeah.
But we don't care about ideas per capita, right? Mm. I mean, if one person is great at coming up with working at a factory and creating a lot more cars than the other person, that's great. Mm. But the thing is, I need millions of cars, not like dozens.
Yeah, but the sort of key take from it in terms of public policy is that through diffusion throughout the whole of the planet, we all benefit. It's an observation, not a criticism, but it's just true that most of the world does no innovation.
Essentially, the amount of R&D, the amount of patent-worthy ideas in most countries is basically rounding error to zero, right? We're all relying on just a couple of basically superhero-level countries to come up with these kinds of innovations, right?
And this is where it gets more challenging. You hint, probably more than hint, that if you do anything to take out, say, a Germany or a France or a Britain, in terms of its innovation and productivity that way, if you do anything to harm it, the prospects for the
whole world, right?
It's the whole world.
So this is why I say I favor open borders for Iceland. So some of my libertarian friends really want open borders for a country. They say, well, why not have it in the US? Mm. And I say, well, the US is so important for the world's innovation. Maybe we should be a little bit risk averse about like playing games with the United States' institutional quality, its level of innovation. There's at least some risk involved here, and I think it's substantial. But as long as one thinks there's some level of risk, you'd say, well, let's just run this experiment in another country. Let's have open borders for Iceland, right? Yeah. Iceland's a nice place. It's a great place. I've been there. Mm. If they became as dense as, if they got the population density of, say, Singapore or even the UK, I mean, they just have, it'd be much bigger, it'd be a much more prosperous, I mean, they could have tens, maybe hundreds of millions more people, right? I mean this sort of as a thought experiment, almost as a joke, a satire of what we should think of. If you're going to run an immigration experiment, don't run it in the I-7.
Yeah, but we are.
We're running it
in a few of them. In a few of them, not all of them, but certainly the ones in the West we are. What happens to France in 100 years' time?
Yeah.
If France looks more like the Middle East, it won't be as innovative, basically.
That seems likely to be true. One never knows with the future because it's uncertain, right?
It is.
But based on the tech history scores, the migration stuff that we've seen in the past, this seems plausible.
So you could end up basically killing the goose.
Killing the goose that lays the golden eggs, even wounding the goose that lays the golden eggs, imposes a cost on the entire planet.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have to say, the flip side of this is that I've written before, like I said, in the piece I wrote for the Telegraph, I took the flip side of this, where I said, well, here's an experiment that I think is safe enough to run, which is the UK really could take high-skilled immigration, dial it up massively, wait 20 or 30 years, and you would see that basically the UK's ranks would rise within the ISA.
I mean, I'd be an advocate of highly skilled. There's no scientists.
It's just hard to pull that off politically, right?
Well, and also,
in the US,
it's hard. No, I think high-skilled, proper high-skilled migration I mentioned before we started the interview this new study in Holland, the Van der Beek study, which categorizes migrant groups in terms of their contribution to the public finances or their negative contribution. And it's a really vast difference. So if you had a policy of having migration of super qualified migrants, I'm sure it would boost GDP. I think the problem is if you have large unskilled migration, which is what we're doing now in this country, the level is so you get paid the minimum wage until they changed it recently and you can get in, which I think is also madness. But anyway, I think the point is very well made. The I-7 is critical to humankind.
Yeah, all of us have a stake.
We all have a stake in it.
How those countries are run and how prosperous they are.
Yeah. Now, before I get on to the final thing, I just want to speak about Singapore in a moment. But do you find, I want to broaden this, do you find as an academic, have you found it difficult to talk about some of these things? Because what you do from the start, I mean, the book, all of your books are data-based because you're an economist. You're just looking at data. And you make the point, quite often it's not a why thing, it's a what thing. What is the case?
Uh-huh.
And you find out what the case is and you tell us. But sometimes even that is quite difficult, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
How's that been?
So it's been, you're right, it has been difficult because what I'm doing is I'm reporting things that economists know in journals.
Mm.
These are widely cited studies. Everybody sort of knows about it.
Yeah.
Somehow economists never talk this way in public with outsiders. It's as if we treat it as a sort of trade secret that we can't reveal to outsiders. It's as if we're running a medieval guild and Alicina's research on how immigration can hurt trust and the welfare state is some kind of trade secret that we dare not share with the outsiders.
Yes.
So I decided to write a book that just shared it with the outsiders.
Yeah.
And what's been the
blowback from that? I mean, this is a very well-meaning book.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Thank you.
Have you had much, conflict because of it? I mean, because some of the things you're saying, noticing certain, some of these things, some people, particularly censorious people, would, particularly on campuses in the United States, surely would see that even looking at some of these questions is almost immoral.
Uh-huh. So yeah, there are some people say there are questions you shouldn't be asking, and economists, fortunately, are a social science that takes the science part seriously. So I have to say, I'm fortunate to be at a department like George Mason, where people value intellectual integrity and where they value
differences.
And discussing controversial ideas in a scientific way. So having the support of a great university and a great department is really important. Not everyone has that. I'm happy to say that other academics who are experts in the field either have written me good blurbs for the book or have given me good reviews. So I have field experts saying, he's conveying the research.
And it's good faith work as well.
Yeah.
That's the point.
I think that helps, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not polemic. It's like, here's just what's going on and here's some lessons to take from it.
Yeah.
You always wonder, like, how would it have done if I made it 50% more politically correct?
I think, no, but if you had done that, it would have been a bigger book.
Yeah.
Because it takes longer to coat all these things in PC language. More boring book, probably. I'm just bringing this up because there is cultural unease. And if you think it's difficult for you as an academic, it's difficult for me as a politician as well.
Uh-huh.
Very difficult. But we talked in this interview a lot about trust and trustworthiness. And what I'm talking here is truth and truthfulness.
You're right. It would be great if these ideas were discussed more often in the halls of political power.
Mm.
These are really mainstream ideas among academics.
Mm.
But keeping track of, as we've learned from some, as I've seen in some recent scholarly debates in my own field, it's become more controversial to actually report that migrants from some countries are more likely to earn a lot more in your country than migrants from other countries. Mm. Like, that is controversial to report now,
but it's true.
In a way that maybe wasn't true a generation ago.
Well, that's really a problem. Because there's civilized toleration of differences.
Yeah.
Well, you'll never get that, at least. And if you try and stifle the truth, you're literally going backwards. I mean,
yeah.
I just think that's... And a point we've made before, researchers like yourself can't do any research or talk about it if you can't
If you
be
can't
honest.
Actually get the data and you can't talk about it publicly and have it discussed publicly. Yeah, it's... it's
basics.
Yeah. But basically, you know, I see this as I'm playing the long game, and over time, these works make it into textbooks, and then they make it into some policy papers, and then eventually they make it into the...
Very important, and there is a filtering out. It does disseminate. What you're doing does work, actually, even if you're here in London today, and we will spread the word, and people talk about it and opens it up. The final thing I want to talk about, just very briefly, is Singapore itself, because this book, The Culture Transplant, is part of a trilogy, isn't it?
Yes,
it's called the Singapore Trilogy, and the first one was Hive Mind, and the second one was 10% less democracy.
Yeah.
And so, what is it with Singapore? I mean, I say, we've had family links there for decades, and I find it a fascinating place. A lot of people are very snooty about it, and don't really approve of it very much. But I think almost it proves the difference. It proves you can make everything from nothing if you've got good governance and a population that's sort of on board. It's an extraordinary miracle.
It's an extraordinary place, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to start with just nothing, a country that was like basically a poor fishing town.
Mm.
And they could have, it seems from an outsider's perspective, could have just become another little post-colonial backwater, not that rich, not the poorest place.
Mm.
And instead, it's become just an unbelievably prosperous place within a few generations. And the question is, what made that happen?
It's
a combination of things. I mean, in one way you can say it's the creation of Lee Kuan Yew, right? It's a one man story, but of course it can't be.
Dr. Goh Keng Swee is the other one that doesn't get mentioned as much, but he is vast. He's incredibly important in that place, just behind Lee Kuan Yew. It's a phenomenal place.
It's a country that captures all parts of all three books of my trilogy, which is the first one shows how having folks with high cognitive scores, no matter how you measure them, IQ test, standardized test, whatever, that seems to be able to just cause prosperity, not just correlate with prosperity. Mm. My second book shows how like going with 100% democracy is probably not the way to prosperity.
Mm.
Singapore has less democracy than I would prefer for the country I live in.
By the way, I wasn't convinced by that particularly. I think it's culturally embedded in a way, but that's fine.
It's good.
That's fine.
You should, yes.
Yeah.
So, but Singapore manages to accomplish a lot of its things probably because it is not fully democratic. That basically it has some elite control. It has these. Its top ministers are paid much more than $1 million a year in their salaries.
Mm.
Private sector levels of salaries helps.
And they talk about externalities
in the
newspapers.
In the newspaper.
And the public read it. Yeah.
Yep.
No, it is a fascinating place, and I think it's fascinating for lots of reasons. I'm glad it's there as proof that you can achieve literally everything from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get onto the question of, I like that, I like that, I like that, I don't like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you really
transportability? Choose, this is the question, you know, in social science, economics and social science, you've got this everywhere because all of these things are culturally rooted. So we get back to the start of your whole premise, which is people say, I mean, I admire Singapore and I read it and I look at it and there's a bit of the PAP and the SDP, but I've never believed that you could pick it up and drop it in.
Yes. One wouldn't know how to do it in the first place, right? And then it wouldn't replicate, probably, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the key thing is I think it wouldn't replicate because of the whole premise of your book, which is that these things are culturally
embedded, yes.
Embedded, and those are the foundations for it. So unless you import the Confucian population to Manchester, it might be a little bit difficult.
It would at least be difficult, yeah.
Listen, thank you very much for coming along and from the States to talk about this. I think you've written a very important book at an important time.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, Garrett. Thank you.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.